Hi, I'm Mari Forth.
And I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
And this is Crime Scene, the true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. We'd love it if you would subscribe to our feed. Please go to robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. You'll get your true crime on Tuesdays, as well as helping to keep this program going.
If you've already subscribed, thank you so much. It makes a big difference. Mari, what did we watch this week?
Well, all this month, we have been reviewing the ABC News Studios series for Hulu. First, we started off with Death in the Dorms in episode 40, Web of Death in episode 43. And this week, we are watching the third and last installment, Killing County. It was produced by Colin Kaepernick, among others, and directed by Michaela Dowd. She has previously directed Breaking Their Silence, Inside the Gymnastics Scandal, and episodes for 2020.
Yeah, that's quite a pedigree.
Yeah. And to talk it all through with us, we have everyone's favorite kid, the wonderful, the marvelous AJ Norris. AJ, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I appreciate y'all for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this project. It was not the most fun project, but I think it is an important one that needs to be talked about and some serious issues that we're going to tackle this episode. And I'm excited to be here to talk to you lovely women.
Welcome, AJ. It's so good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
AJ, since this is your first time to the scene, can you tell us what your true crime origin story is? Like, what got you into true crime? What kind of true crime do you originally like to really get into?
Like, I think the first true crime I remember getting into was like in bed with my mama watching Snap. Yes, and we just would watch all of those stories and some unsolved mysteries, and like even to this day, like there are some things I will watch with my mama, and one of them is Fatal Attraction. And
on BET, yes. I'm a fan.
Yes, so I think my mom's interest came on to me, so I listened to some podcasts, watched some YouTube videos, and became like, okay. True crime is interesting. They're like, there was like this entire year or something where people was like, what's the ethical
behind ethical true crime consumption?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, now I got to question it. So now I'm like, okay, I feed out like what is good true crime and what is like people that's exploiting these horrific things that happen.
Exactly. That's where we're all about here.
Yes.
Yes. Before we get into what we're reviewing today, Sarah, you have some true crime news for us?
Yes. So in episode 36, we covered the docuseries Low Country, The Murdaugh Dynasty with Sarah D. Bunting. And that's on HBO Max in the US and Binge in Australia if you want to catch up, if you haven't seen it. And another docuseries has just dropped on Netflix called Murdaugh Murders, A Southern Scandal. Once we see that, we'll report our thoughts in a mini review. But his trial is ongoing. So Alex Murdaugh's trial for the June 2021 murder of his wife, Margaret, and his son, Paul, began on January the 25th. And you can watch it live on YouTube, courtesy of WCNC, which is the NBC affiliate in Charlotte, should you wish to follow it. And I mean, that's something we can talk about, like, should these trials be televised? Yeah. Should they be filmed? Should we be watching them and armchair prosecuting people? I don't know.
It's always a thin line, because I think it's good to have a lot of eyes in courtroom setting, because I think a lot of people don't understand all of the process of courtrooms. They, you know, they think of shows like Law and Order and stuff like that, and it's never as fluid as some of those shows make it out to be, you know? And it's always good to have eyes. Like in high profile cases like this, you know, people are going to be like on the up and up, but there are cases that happen every day across the country that nobody's looking at. And there's lots of like rampant corruption happening. So I do believe that we do need more eyes in courtrooms, but there is again, a line between, are we there to make sure the letter of the law is followed, or are we there to gossip around the water cooler, you know, and not really think about the people who actually lost their lives? So,
yeah,
a little bit.
Do we need do we need to educate ourselves as viewers about what we're watching? So a couple of things from last week that I thought I'd highlight. The defense put forward a motion to exclude questions from the prosecution about Alec Murdaugh's financial affairs, should he take the stand. They haven't decided yet whether he will or not. The prosecution is asserting that it was the financial difficulties which led in part to the murders of Maggie and Paul, and including an impending civil suit over the 2019 death of Mallory Beach in a boat that Paul was allegedly driving, allegedly intoxicated. Paul is dead now, so he will never stand trial for that. The judges reserved their decision there, most likely not allow that motion to exclude. It's too broad, it's too blanket, but will allow the defence to object to questions as they come up, should Alex take the stand. And as far as Mallory Beach's family goes, they have reached a settlement with Buster Murdaugh. Follow along, everybody. We'll put up a chart. That's Alex's surviving son. The estate has come to him now. And the Beach family has settled for $275,000 for the killing of their daughter. It seems so paltry, but we'll talk about those kind of settlement figures when we talk about the property that we're talking about today. The other thing I wanted to highlight was that Buster was in the news with an extraordinary photograph. You probably would have seen it if you've got any antenna for true crime. It's Alex patting his bum during a break in the trial. So he walks behind his son, pats him in a friendly, fatherly way on the bottom. The reason this has taken fire is, of course, as most people would know or even just imagine in their own heads, accused people in the courtroom are never allowed to touch anybody. And in fact, some are shackled at the legs and chained to a table. And I'll leave it to you to imagine who gets what kind of treatment. That Alex Murdaugh, even as a presumed innocent accused person, is allowed such freedom is a stark reminder that everyone is not equal under the law, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much for that update, Sarah. And like we said, we're going to keep you guys up to date on a lot of the cases we follow. This one is ongoing. So if you have any questions about any cases that we should, or if you think there's something we should be following, you know, you can always reach out to us. crimescenerhap@gmail.com. To the crime. So we watched a three-part docuseries that investigates the Bakersfield Police Department in Kern County, California, called The Deadliest Police Force in the Country by The Guardian. There were 33 killings by police from 2013 to 2021. In 16% of the cases where guns were perceived, air quotes, no guns were found. In 68% of fatal police shootings, no non-lethal methods were attempted first. Nationwide, 10 to 12% of criminal misconduct complaints against police are upheld. In Bakersfield, it is 6%, with 0% of excessive force complaints upheld. So clearly, they're not being held accountable. Killing County focuses on the deaths of Jorge Ramirez, working as a confidential informant and shot 10 times during a bungled apprehension in 2013. David Silva, beaten to death by 9 law enforcement officers during a mental health crisis in 2013. Jason Alderman, shot and killed during an attempted robbery in 2015. James De La Rosa was shot and killed during a traffic stop where witnesses said his hands were in the air and police said he reached for his waistband in 2014. And 74-year-old Francisco Cerna, who had senile dementia, which was known to the police, but they still shot and killed him in his driveway in 2016. None of these men were armed. Okay, so we have another docuseries here. It's another three-parter. Like we said, it's on Hulu. What was everybody's overall thoughts about this docuseries? This very weighty docuseries about, in essence, police brutality. I don't even know if it's in essence. It's about police brutality and excessive force. AJ, what did you think of this property? Just like broad terms.
Well, this property is coming from Kaepernick Entertainment. So I fully understood what I was getting myself into, if I'm being completely honest with you.
Yeah.
But it still did not stop the weight of what was happening to really hit me hard. Like these are not easy stories of like these men of color, like in many cases, well, in the, at least especially in the Selena cases, was like not asking for trouble was asking for help, or situations where they should never have been gunned down, or in a situation where a gun should have even been pulled. And yet I'm having to not only watch what happens, but then watch the cover up, watch these police work for each other to keep things on hush hush and ignored. So it was like, it was a well done documentary, in my humble opinion. It was like,
a good watch,
but still did not make it any less hard.
Exactly. Perfectly said. Sarah, how about you?
Yes, it's a tough watch, everybody, and there's some pretty disturbing vision and audio. Plus, the subject matter is tough. But I feel like we need to watch it, especially when it's as well made. Spoiler, as well made as this. But I also think the coming together of the community of the bereaved families, as I say, it's a wonderful, incredible club that you never want to be a member of. Gives both the, you know, part of the reality of the story, and also as a viewer, gives us, it's not quite relief, but it's something, it's a place to rest. It's like we go and stand with those families.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. This property was very hard to watch. I admit I was like the one person who was kind of like, I don't even know if I want us to cover this because, you know, as a Black woman in this country, and I'm sure AJ can attest to, police brutality, police shootings, police killings of unarmed men of color, people of color, Black men, Black women. It's something that I have had to deal with my entire life, have to be cognizant of my entire life. And it feels like it's just been getting so much worse, you know, the last few years. We know that's not the case. We just know that what's been happening the last few years is we've been able to document it. We've been able to see it. We, you know, it's become more prevalent. It's become more widely observed. So it was tough. I honestly was like, I don't really want to put myself through this, but I, like you said, it's very important to actually watch this and to actually discuss this and to actually talk about this, because it's happening. We can't close our eyes to it. It's truly happening. And I really thought that this was a very well done documentary that focused on a part of the country that I had no idea about. I thought it was very interesting that this is basically a lot of the victims that they focus on here, and the community is like very like a Latino community. So that's also a different, you know, spin to it. It's like, if you're numbed by seeing all of these Black bodies, well, guess what? It's also happening in other communities as well. You know, does that make sense? It's like, we all have to come together against law enforcement overdoing it. It doesn't matter what your color or your creed. It's like, they do not have the right to kill people on site. It doesn't matter what the offense is. Like, that's not how the justice system is supposed to work. It doesn't matter if you're in the act of committing a crime. It doesn't matter if you called the police for help. They should not kill you. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's not how it works. So I thought that this docuseries really showed the breadth of the victims, and the different instances was very interesting, but it's not like the docuseries picked these victims out. This is what happened. This is what happened directly in this county, so close together and so interwoven. So it's not like it's sensationalized or anything like that. It's literally telling the story of this community that is basically terrorized by this police department, in one way to put it, you know? So
like four of these five murders happened within a year of each other. And the last one happened within a year out. And as the documentary shows, that wasn't even all the murders that happened that year. Like, there was like a baker's dozen worth of murders that happened in this small community itself by this police department. And it's like, very disgusting, like how little accountability is actually being taken from the police department. Like, I know you do get some interviews from officers throughout this documentary. You do not hear from this police department. They refuse to talk. You do not hear from them. There's no accountability at any point for them, which is one of the more disgusting parts of this documentary, in my humble opinion.
I completely agree. So let's talk about the production itself. Let's start off with that. I thought the production value of this was really good. As somebody who came into this, I literally came into this like, oh God, I don't like, I was really like, like, I knew about the subject matter. I was like, I know this is important, but God, I'm so scared. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, I was so resistant. And even as it first started, I was like, okay. Because my thoughts when I first started, I was like, oh, it is really well produced. But I'm like, man, is this boring though? But as you continue to watch it and you see where they were going, I was like, oh, I get it. Like, it's one of those things where if you watch the first 15 minutes, you're like, what is happening? But then by the time that you loop around to the first episode, you're like, I see. Because they very well, they narratively laid all of these things out in a way that was very, very interesting. Like, it didn't feel like twists and turns. It felt like they're trying to show the viewer what the community was seeing as the crimes were unfolding. Does that make sense? Like, we start with the crime of Jorge Ramirez's death. And at first, you're just like, okay, was Jorge with the wrong guy at the wrong time? And he ends up getting shot and killed and murdered. And you're like, man, so what, you know, so where does this go from here? And then as it, you know, as it unravels and as the story's being told, you're like, oh my God, Jorge was working with the police that night to help them apprehend this man. And because the police acted like bumbling, trigger happy idiots, he ends up dying as well when he's trying to help them. So it was, man, it was so well produced. And that's to say, and that's not even to say what the actual production and having the actors read some of the statements and stuff. Sarah, what did you think of the production?
Yes, I mean, there's two things. There's the events and the truths that they're talking about, and then there's the way it's presented to us. And I'll just talk about that first. I greatly admire Michaela Dowd here, the way she lays out this story narratively. And I think you're right, Mari. She doesn't rely on twist at the end of an episode. Aha, it's a twist. She just says this is what happened. She uses the members of the community to talk to us about either their family member or the state of Bakersfield. And she very cleverly has some family members talking about the murders of other people, not their family. And you think, oh, that's interesting. And slowly that appears that, for example, Selena's brother was shot by the man that Jorge was informing on. Mm-hmm. And then she filmed the death of David Silva. And Chris Silva, whose brother died, witnessed the death of Francisco Cerna. And rather than making these huge twists and flashes, it just lays it open for you. So I think the narrative over the three episodes is so beautifully done, very hard to watch, and yet it draws you through. And it's, the, as you say, Mari, the revelation of the information as the community understood it, as they heard it, is fantastic. Just to talk briefly about there's a narrator. We're not used to narrators. I think in all the things we've ever discussed, there's only ever been one narrator. And I think a narrator here is a fantastic idea. It's Andre Holland. You may know him from Moonlight. He has a long resume and a great career.
Amazing actor.
Amazing. And his voice both envelops and encourages us, but also impels us to watch. He's not making anything easy for us. And I think it's such a great selection to have a narrator at all and to cast Andre Holland to do it. And the other actors that they use read parts of depositions, police statements, the people who will not come and be interviewed by the documentary filmmaker. So the documentarians go, well, all right, well, we have your words. And we will have actors read them looking directly into camera. And I thought, great, you're not making me read text on a screen. And it has this very strange humanizing effect where you go, oh, that was an actual police officer who saw this and made this statement about their experience. So I think that was a really good decision made by the documentarians. AJ?
It was really well produced, my humble opinion. I really did like the actors. Emmy, I think she did an amazing job, as long as Andre and honestly the rest of them. Like, it really did have me hooked. And I really was just, throughout the documentary, I was like, okay, why are you having me sit through another heartbreaking story? Why am I have to, oh, this is connected. And not only is this connected, because I know a lot of times you hear with these, okay, it's a bad cop or something like that. Like, this documentary was showing like how the entire police department, how that from top to bottom, like there is problems that is not even being addressed by them and ignored, and how if how like not only connected, but like how many of these deaths could have been prevented if like someone more responsible were doing something different in this situation. Because there's like a lot of negligence that take place at points and times. It also was like a little bit confusing for me because it was like uh-huh. a lot of different, you're throwing a lot at me at different points and like very fast. It's only like three episodes. It's only like each one of these cases could have had a whole mini series to it. So but overall I was impressed with the production and what they gave me in the short span of time.
I agree. That's what I said. That first, like the first like 15 or 20 minutes of the first episode, I was very thoroughly confused. I was like, who? What? It took me a while to catch up, but I rewound a few times, but I got there and I was like, oh, I'm glad I'm here. You know, it was, they talked about Jorge Ramirez's life. They gave that to us first in a sense. And they told us a little bit about him being like an addict and basically how him being an addict led to his rap sheet. Mm-hmm. But we later find out, you know, because of his rap sheet and all of that, he tries to then turn at be a confidential informant. Then we find out he was like an off the books confidential informant. And then we find out that like one of the detectives that he's a CI for was famous. And then tell me if I'm going too far here, but then he was famous, but then he turned into a drug dealer. Like this was, let's talk like, about this, right? So let's talk about DeMarcio Diaz, right? So he's a Kern County police officer. And at first, and he's here telling his story, right? Like he's sitting down and talking to us. And so he's telling a story. He's talking about how he goes to police academy and how he wants to be a police officer. And he thinks he has a vision of what he thinks being a police officer is going to be. But then when he finishes time in the academy, he goes to be a police officer, and then they put him in like undercover, they put him in vice. And when he's telling the story, I was like, like this happens so often with police officers of color, Black police officers. Like the first thing Black FBI agents, CIA agents, what they'll do is they'll use your identity in order to get you to infiltrate groups in order to inform on your community, you know, which is a very thin line, you know? And so I was like, dang, Taylor Soul's time. They're using him to really like bust up some of these drug offenses, but he likes it. He becomes famous. I am still kind of confused about the McFarlane USA of it all. Sarah, did you understand that part?
Sort of tangentially. I kind of figured it wasn't vital to the story, but it did contribute to DeMarcio's kind of elevated opinion of himself that he was the inspiration for a Kevin Costner film. He and his brothers were great runners, apparently. We have photographs of him and the Hollywood lifestyle, which I thought, well, you're a Bakersfield police officer. I think it just showed, and he admitted to the incremental tiny steps that you take over the line, and suddenly you're so far over the line and you didn't quite know how you got there. It's a little bit disingenuous because you are a police officer, but I thought what was interesting about him and what we do here in the beginning is how the regard in which the police department in Bakersfield is held. So he thought the police were great. Yes. And we do hear from family members of murdered people murdered by police. We do hear from them before this happened, I had high regard for the police. And I believed the news report when it said Jorge or some other person with a Latinx name was a drug addict, was a petty criminal. Oh, okay, all right, fine. Yeah. So I thought that part was interesting too, sorry to jump, but that the police use the media to position these killed and murdered people in a particular way. Yes, so DeMarcio's with us and now tells us I mean, it sounds like he was disciplined. He was certainly arrested in the police station. Yeah.
In the first episode, you cannot almost think that he was a good cop, you know, but by the time it's revealed that he started busting criminals with drugs, he would turn in a portion of the drugs for police evidence, and then he would sell the rest of the drugs. And so him and his partner, Patrick Mara, would do this, and they were both they were taken to court, and they did. I can't remember what their punishment was, like Sarah said, but we do have footage of them like being tried. But the reason why I brought it up is, one, he was a drug dealing cop, but two, his partner, Patrick Mara, was the person who had contacted Jorge Ramirez to be a confidential informant. Unfortunately, when Jorge Ramirez was trying to help catch criminal Justin Hager, Mara was off duty at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting how he was trying to help the police. He was going through Mara. Mara was relaying the information that Jorge was relaying to him to the other police officers, but he forgot or did not tell them, or a lot of them that didn't know that there was a confidential informant there with the suspect. And not only did they not know, but they had no plan to take in Justin Hager, who is known to be armed and dangerous. Mm-hmm. And again, Justin Hager, he was wanted on multiple counts, but one of shooting this woman named Selena's brother. Mm-hmm. And so when they go to do this takedown of Justin Hager, they kill Justin and Jorge. They smear Jorge's name. It is up to Jorge's family to find out that he is a confidential informant. And with help of the press, they finally get that out, because for weeks they were just calling Jorge, you know, a criminal, when they're like, we know he's not. We know he's had rough times and we know he's an addict, but he's not a criminal. And this was the story that led off. And I thought it was very, very important to lead off with this story, because if you're just watching the beginning of it and they're presenting it kind of like how the police officers present it, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, the guy he was with, Justin, started firing at the police, so it makes sense that they would fire back. You know what I'm saying? Like almost justification. But then it starts to unravel that, no, these police officers are the reason that they shouldn't have even been in this situation. If they had approached it differently, then Jorge wouldn't have died. And again, even though Justin is armed and dangerous and a horrible human, he should not have died. He should have been apprehended and tried.
Yeah. And so, and here we have Mark Claxton and Jared Bergenwan, who are both former police officers, one from New York and one from San Bernardino. And they are commenting very tactfully on the behavior of the Bakersfield police. And here is one of the first things that Mark Claxton says is, well, you approach someone from behind shelter. You are hiding behind something if you think they might shoot you. So the fact that Justin Hager shot at them from the car should not necessarily mean that you would automatically return fire. And I found the insights, the glimpses into, let's say, correct procedure that we got from Mark and Jared and some others to be very illuminating. I mean, they're used sparingly and they're not apologizing for police actions, but they gave us that insight. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. And then in the third episode, right towards the end, when Jorge's father, who just is the emotional center of this documentary, when he says, my son was shot 10 times, I got it. I thought, 10 times? Why do you need to shoot someone 10 times? Are they a cocaine-fueled bear? No, they're a person. Why do you need to shoot them at all? Why do you need to shoot them 10 times? And as Murray said, the entire operation was completely flawed. They were late, they didn't have information, and they didn't have a plan.
Like, Julie, the further I got into the documentary, the more disgusted I became with the situation. Because I felt gross, because you will see this frequently, like we saw it with George Floyd murders. Like someone unlawfully murdered by the police, and then you hear the spin, like, oh, this person had these this rap sheet, these difficulties, these demons that they have to deal with. And almost like being like, listen, it's okay they died. Like, listen, they had these issues. When it's like, no, like Sarah said, this is a person. These are human people. And you don't just be shooting someone 10 times in a row. And then you find out he's an informant. And it's like, so he was with you guys. He was on your side. And y'all still muddied his name after his death. Like, like, you cannot have him rest. You cannot let his family rest. Because not only did you murder him, like, the damage that came from his family and having to like defend his name from you. And the fact that you did not have a plan, you have one of the most wanted men in your county. Noah is dangerous. And whether or not they knew there was an informant there, because some people was like, I didn't, not everyone was aware. Everyone should have been aware of this. You should have had a proper plan to apprehend the subject. And yes, because one of the talking heads, they were saying, you can plan all you want, but then you have to be prepared in case things go south. Like, and I'm like, sure. But in that case scenario, your plan is, this is what happens. So we can have as little casualties on our side and to try to get both men out of the situation alive. And the fact that they just went in willy nilly was disgusting.
They were shooting in the parking lot of a Four Points by Sheraton. They were shooting in a hotel parking lot. They could have hit anybody. Like, anybody.
Like, they got a call from someone in their hotel room being like, I just threw up in 30 shots. I need someone to come down because the police, they're going crazy.
And the 911 operator is slightly exasperated. Ma'am, we're already there. We're already there. But, yeah, this woman is scared. She just heard 30 shots right outside her hotel room. Yeah, no need for exasperation, 911 operator.
That and we've heard, you know, in this next case, you got to call the police on the police. I definitely want to really talk about the David Silva case. This one was so sad. I mean, they're all very sad, but this one was heart-wrenching because it is probably the closest we get to a George Floyd style murder. And it's all caught on video by a passerby, and they use the audio and the video of this, unfortunately, very effectively. Like, it really is the stuff of nightmares. Like, I'm uncomfortable because the video that we get of David Silva, the video we can't really see it, you know, it's from across the street. I think they tactfully didn't use a lot of the video. Plus, we find out that the police really tried to obscure the video. They tried to they took the phones of the people who had the video. I don't even know how they got the few clips that we saw, because the police tried to take them and cover it up. But the biggest thing is the sounds and the screams and Silva trying to breathe and the screaming. It truly, and they play it over and over, but not, I would actually say, in not a gross way. They do play it in a very effective way. It doesn't feel overdone. And it feels like they're doing it because it's important to hear that this man was really looking for help. So David Silva was looking for help. He went to the hospital. He was having a mental health crisis. They turned him away. They told him to go across the street. He starts walking across the street. At some point, he's found on the corner, like, asleep. And somebody calls the police on him, you know, saying this guy is out here. He's asleep. First responding officer does like a sternum rub to like wake him up. And I don't know if apparently, like, they said when he woke up, you know what the police say. The police will say he woke up aggressively, but more officers responded to the scene of the crime. Well, not the scene of the crime, because there was no crime until they got there. They responded to the scene and they rolled up. I think how many police cars did Salinas count?
Seven deputies, two highway patrol officers.
Yes. And they seek their dog on him. They hog tied him. They put a spit bag over his head. They beat him with their batons. And 19 minutes after they roll up, David Silva is dead. What did we think about this part with David Silva, Sarah?
Murray, can you go over the description from the pathologist and from the coroner's office? I mean, just to answer your question briefly, I think the use of the video is judicious. It's really, really, really hard to watch and even more so to listen to. Then Selena, the woman whose brother was shot by Justin Harger, happens to be filming it. Mm-hmm. She talks about she is still in therapy mm-hmm. for having mm-hmm. witnessed that. But then they go to an animation to show you what was done. It was hogtied, mm-hmm. which almost all police departments have outlawed. Mm-hmm. They put us, and and when they do the animation to show you what happens to the body, it bends backwards in a bow. Mm-hmm. And then to put a spit hood on his head. Spit hoods are a huge issue here in Australia at the moment. So I had an idea of what they were, but to see on the animation what they actually are mm-hmm. was horrifying. But I think with the animation, it allowed us to look at it easily isn't the right word, but to take mm-hmm. in the information. So I think the way yes. this was all couched was really very, very good. But Murray, mm-hmm. can you talk a little about the autopsy report, which showed the bites, which showed the bruises, which showed all of that, and the manner and the cause of death?
Yes.
Aiden. Mm-hmm. I want to say the moment I heard the first, I don't know if scream is the right word, like, mm-hmm. but like I genuinely had to pause it because I've seen enough of these videos.
Exactly.
Like I had to physically, I was like, do I really want to watch this or do I just want to skip over it? But I had to like physically, mentally prepare myself for what I might be able to see in here. And it's wild because I understand why they did it because 19 minutes, mm-hmm. he went from in the hospital. The police was called saying he's under the influence. But he needs some help and he's extremely relaxed. Like mm-hmm. you go from extremely relaxed, need some help to dead in 19 yeah. minutes. Like that is so insane to me, especially mm-hmm. considering first, why is there 9 officers there for this one man who's mm-hmm. just like sleep for all they know is sleeping on the corner. Like why yes. are like you do not need 9 people to help. Like they were called for help, not to like exactly. take action. And one of the talking heads, they said any trained professional knows that the sternum rub will cause a physical reaction. So mm-hmm. so they would so the fact that the physical reaction is what caused the police officer to react the way he did just shows like the improper training and the lack of knowledge that we send these people out into the field with and mm-hmm. shows like there needs to be like some change in how we train the people, but you can go ahead and talk about the coroner's report.
Yeah. I think honestly, I don't think we should be calling cops for mental health crises because all they mm-hmm. tend to do is tend to shoot people. So mm-hmm. I really wish that we could get like mental health services. Like there'd be a whole separate like mental health services, mental mm-hmm. health phone line to call like, actually licensed mental health care professionals for stuff like this. But, you know, that's one point of, you know, abolition that people don't talk about as much because they're so hung up on defund the police. Mm-hmm. When you could take that money from the police and set up mental health crisis lines. But so, yeah, let's talk about the pathologist notes. So De Silva has numerous bite marks on him because they sicked a dog on him for, again, no reason. Because from what we understand, this man just was always on the ground. Like they found him on the ground and he stayed on the ground because they didn't let him up. He also had like abrasions and trauma to the left side of his head, probably from the batoning, the kicking. He had bruises and abrasions all over his body. But they said that none of them were lethal. None of those contusions and abrasions were lethal. What killed him was a acute, like a cardiac. He basically had a heart attack because, I mean, mm-hmm. again, we've seen it with Eric Garner in 2014. It's like, if you are beating me up and you're hog tying me and I cannot breathe and I'm in a scary situation, what do you think your heart's going to do? Your heart is going to give out, you know, as somebody who suffers like panic attacks and stuff like that, like it's not fun. It's not fun. And I can only imagine how that man felt seeing their hog tied beat. But the problem here is the difference between cause of death and manner of death. So again, the cause of death was a heart attack, an acute heart attack. So what's supposed to happen is, yes, that's the cause of death, but you're supposed to then take in consideration when you put in manner of death, that's either, you know, homicide, suicide, accident, or unknown, right? So with manner of death, the coroner takes in all of the information. So cause of death is just what happened to the body, how the person died. Manner of death is taking all of that information that you know about the scene, what happened to the person before the injuries were inflicted, how the injuries were inflicted, and, you know, the cause of the injuries, who inflicted the injuries, then you say a manner of death. So the coroner has to know all of that information to say manner of death. What we're told was the sheriff's office told the coroner, hi, this is a guy, this is his body, there is no foul play, write this up. If that's what the coroner is told, they look at all these bites. They don't know how he got the bites. They don't know how he got the blunt force trauma to the head. But then they're like, well, but he had a heart attack. He ruled it an accident because he probably thought, well, he accidentally got bit by a dog and had a heart attack because he doesn't know what the situation is. Now, I still don't know because the coroner works for the sheriff. But if the sheriff tells the coroner, well, you know, we seeked our canine unit on him, we beat him and hogtied him, you know, that kind of spurred on the heart attack, you would hope that the coroner would be like, well, that is a homicide, because that is not what you're supposed to do. You know what I'm saying? That should be the ruling. The ruling should, like, I think one of the talking heads said, I feel like out of all that information, if it was given to the coroner, they would have ruled it a homicide. And unfortunately, because of the cover up, they did not tell the coroner that. And unfortunately, in this county, like many counties in California, the coroner works for the sheriff's department. It's not a separate department like it is in some other states and some other counties. So again, we still don't fully know, because maybe even with all that information, the county, the coroner would have ruled it an accident. And so the courts go off of what the manner of death is and stuff like this. So if the coroner rules it an accident, then they can't legally charge anybody for homicide for that, the death of that person, because it conflicts with the coroner's report. So putting accident there basically means that there can be no accountability. And it's just very, very unfortunate for the Silva family. And Chris Silva is here with us in the documentary. He's a great talking head. He talks to us about how his advocacy and his, you know, being a protester and connecting with all these other families and kind of showing them how they can get justice for their family members. Anything else about David Silva before we move on?
Very disheartening. Like, the thing that stuck out, it was the last line from the sheriff that they played. And he said, what is better, to cripple him or to kill him? The answer is to kill him. And, like, the fact that that is the mindset that you have, your sheriff has that mindset, and that's the mindset he pushes to all the other police officers, shows that there is a inherent disconnect of what morally is right when you have this badge on as a police officer, and what you should be do whenever you enter a situation where things does not go right.
Exactly. And because they can't criminally charge these officers, then the family has to settle for a civil lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And so Chris Silva was awarded $3.4 million for David Silva's death. And, you know, like AJ said, there was a video showing that the sheriff was like, $3 million and the family goes away. So we'd much rather to pay the $3 million and you guys can kill them. It's like so flippant and it's so preposterous. And, you know, Chris says it's like not about the money. It's like, it's just about, at least they feel like if you're paying me off, then you're admitting guilt in a sense, even though they are not required to take liability for the death when they do the settlement.
But these settlement monies don't come from the police's pocket. They don't come from the police's pension fund. They don't come from the police's funding. It comes from the taxpayers. So there's no punishment at all, not even a financial one. And the other murders. I was going to say wrongful deaths. I'm going to call them murders. The other murders are settled for between $100,000 and $400,000. That sounds like a lot of money to me, but not for a whole person. Exactly. And the mother of Jason Alderman cries when she says that she took $100,000. She's almost ashamed that she took such a low amount, but she needed it for his children. And because not David Silver, the others are criminalized. Oh yes, they were bad people. They were wrong people. You get $3 million if we beat you to death in a mental health crisis, but you only get $100,000 if you're a petty burglar and you were carrying a tire iron and we decided as you crawled out of a door to just shoot you.
Yeah, that was very hard to watch.
Like, and I don't like to think of it like, oh, this was the price tag of just their life. Like, this is the price tag for this person's life, as well as the trauma that she caused their family, who could be a father, who could be a mother, who could be a son, a daughter, whatever, for the therapy that everyone's going to have to endure going forward. Like, this is like just taking this one life, no matter whose it is, whether or not they're a criminal or not. Whatever their background is, like, that is such a rippling hole that you cannot fill. That is not a hole that can be. Like, these deaths happened in 2013 and this was produced 2023. So that's like a decade, and they are still having to live with the actions of these police officers.
Exactly.
And they just press a price tag and just keep it moving because they're like, there's no real incentives for us to change. There's no real punishment for the officers who committed these crimes.
There's no punishment. We're told in an end tag that there's no punishment for the officers at all. They are placed on administrative leave and then they come back, if at all. And one of them, and I'm going to say their name, Rick Wimbish.
Yeah.
Wimbitch, more like, was involved in three of the shootings, Jorge, James, and Jason. And we see his deposition. And if you imagine a good old boy in a police uniform, you know exactly what this man looks like. I mean, one of the things that they do talk about the police force in Bakersfield, and I'm sure elsewhere, but it's very prevalent there, is that everyone is related or knows someone. It's a family business almost. And although you do have Latinx and Black police officers, the police officers that we see, especially when they're paraded out for a press announcement, seem universally white. And in episode two, and I don't want to say this jokingly, but it was, oh, okay, yes, here comes the Klan. I was wondering how long it would take for us to get to the Klan. Episode two starts with a kind of historical idea of what Bakersfield is. It's California, but it feels like Texas, they say, which was very interesting to me. The talk about sundown towns, I have heard that phrase before, but when it's explained to you by a person of color, by a man of color, I cannot be in that town after the sun goes down. There was a constant personalization. Of course we know it's people. Of course we know it's humans. But one thing that Michaela Dowd does is constantly personalized. We talk to the actual person that it's affecting, or the many people, which is why, as I say, I liked the actors reading the depositions because it was a person there. So we lens out a little bit and look at the history of the town, at the Klan, and it's like it's still shocking that they were so open. They were advertising in the newspaper, come on down to the meeting, because we think of them now as sort of secretive and we have to investigate and find out who's a member. It was all the openness of it is shocking to me, and it shouldn't be. So I liked that. And then we dive back into the cases again, starting with James De La Rosa, who is the young man pulled over by the cops. Witnesses say he had his hands in the air. The police say he was reaching for his waistband. And then there's a quick explanation from one of our law enforcement talking heads about, oh, yes, the reaching for the waistband. They all know to say that.
And even if James was reaching for his waistband, we learned from his family that he lost like a lot of weight. So he might have just been reaching to pull his waistband up because his clothes hadn't been fitting him lately. It's just so annoying. It doesn't matter. Like, there should be no excuse to kill somebody in a routine traffic stop because you're mad, you know, as a police officer. And it's just very, very, very annoying. Let's wrap this up. Let's give our last thoughts about the final thoughts about the cases themselves before we go into the updates to the crimes. What did we feel about them highlighting each one of these victims' cases? AJ, what did you think about that?
Like, it's interesting because they're different cases, but with the same ending. Like, at the end of the day, like, whether you were a 74-year-old man with dementia or you're a young father helping out the police, like, it did not matter to these people. Like, they were really a shoot first, ask questions later type of mindset that was going on. And it really did, like, hurt every time, like, seeing, okay, this is this person. And no matter what they've done in their life, they meant the world to a lot of people. Like, a lot of people are distraught, and it really does recontextualize, like, sure, these officers are going out into the field, but, like, their actions are really long lasting, and it hurts watching them, but, like, I'm glad I watched all of them. And it really did, like Sarah said, watching at the end, seeing them, like, still come together, support each other. I know what you're feeling, and we need to make change. And them ultimately going to the DOJ and, like, getting a law passed. Like, it is really great to see such tragedy produce change. Truly.
Sarah, final thought?
Yes. I mean, I'm going to recommend that people see it. Don't wait for the laughs, because there aren't any. It's so well made. I think we see Kamala Harris saying the Department of Justice is going to do an investigation, which they do. The instruction is sent down by Rob Bonta, who's the state attorney of California. You can't do this anymore. Your actions are incorrect. And then we see the sheriff, Youngblood, son of the previous sheriff, Youngblood, stand at the podium and say, well, they're all wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. And so while there is a hope for change, a press for change, I mean, two British reporters did the Guardian story, which broke a lot of this open. There is still a thought of what is changing. We must continue to fight. So the family's going to continue to fight. The journalists are going to continue to ask difficult questions. And the legal system slowly is revolving towards actual justice. After you finish the third episode, you do sit with a lot of thoughts.
It's interesting. It's like they're trying to put down consent decrees. They're trying to enforce reforms on that police department, but the police department itself doesn't want to. So it's a push and a pull. There again, there's also nothing to really make them do it. So it's just going to have to take constant pressure, constant focus on that police department, as well as many police departments across the nation. Like, that's really what it's going to be. Like Chris Silva said, like, you might just get 15 minutes. So make sure with that 15 minutes before they move on to the next news story that they understand what's going on, that you can protest, use your time to shed light on what is happening so that you can try and spark real change, because change can't happen overnight. It takes time, and you have to be consistent. And one of the things I will say to people here in the U.S., like, you have to vote for your sheriff. Your sheriff is, you vote for them. So when you're voting for sheriff, make sure you know who you're voting for. You know what I'm saying? We can be very lackadaisical in elections, not knowing who we're voting for. Like, oh, that's the guy who's been doing it for this long. Let me just vote for him. Oh, the last name Youngblood, we've had a Sheriff Youngblood for the past 30 years. Let's vote for him. Make sure you know who you're voting for when it comes to your sheriff's department, when it comes to your state attorney, when it comes to any electable law enforcement position. Make sure you know that person's stance on everything before you vote for them, because that is one of the ways that you can affect true change locally. That's how you can locally affect change that you will feel immediately.
One of the places that Murray and I got our information about the Bakersfield Police Department from, and there's plenty there, is a fantastic website called Your Police Health Check, something like that. We'll put it in the show notes. And you're able to look at, in America, look at your own police department, and it will give you all sorts of statistics and against a national average. And that's how we found out about guns perceived to guns found, whether people have been punished, how many violent offences there are, and so on. So as you go to your election, just have a look and look at your police department in the US and see what their standing is. There's this enormous amount of information in very easy and stark graphs to see.
Yes, and I will also like to piggyback off of what Mari says. Like, voting your local elections, and it's very important. Like, not to, like, you know, out where I live, but I know we recently voted for a sheriff who was actively bad, like, for our community. And I know this because he's currently not in the job, even though he was voted for in the last election. He was removed because he is currently in prison. However, he had this like great personality and stuff, like this fun young thing. And it was like, we need this new energy. And it's like, no, look at, and I looked at his beliefs and stuff. I was like, no, this is not a good person for our community. And like, also sometimes you will vote for like certain laws, like make sure you understand those laws. Cause in the last election, I, at my community, I know I voted for like what type of overreach can the sheriff have here. So like, it's very important for you to not only vote in your local elections, but like also like see this change. You need to organize, advocate, protest, call your local senators, call your mayors, write to them for legislative change. Because I'm be $1.50 with you. I've seen in the federal legislature, you know, that George Floyd police and that's been stuck there forever. Like, you have to make the change locally. First, and I think that is where you can really make your impact. So go out, do what you can do, whether it's like speaking about it, donating, whatever it is you can do, do what you can to help make the change.
Yeah. Great point. So a little bit of updates to this documentary. In early February, Colin Kaepernick tweeted, "Based on what we uncovered, we created the Autopsy Initiative, which provides free second autopsies to families who have lost loved ones in police killings. We have completed 40 autopsies since the program launched last year." So very heartbreaking that that's needed, but I think it is definitely needed, unfortunately. So, AJ, how many magnifying glasses are you going to rate Killing County out of a possible 5?
I'm going to give it personally a 4.5. I feel like this was extremely well done. Such an important watch. I think the talking heads all made sense on why they were there, on what they were talking about. The stories made sense, and it was a very well written documentary, which got their point across without turning me off and not without boring me.
Yep.
Besides like the little confusion I had at the start of it, because I also had to rewind a few times, I think overall I really enjoyed it and would recommend it.
Sarah, how many magnifying glasses are you going to rate this series out of a possible 5?
I'm going to go 5 with this one. It's so well made. It's such a difficult subject, and it doesn't shy away from it. I think the selections of the talking heads was very thoughtful, and I wanted to stop watching almost every minute, and yet the documentary compelled and required me to keep watching. So I am going to say 5, and watch it, please, everybody. Mari?
I'm going to give it a 4.5. Like AJ said, I think that those first few minutes or so of being very confused really didn't help me. And I can see how if somebody else was watching this who didn't force themselves to watch it, I could see them turning it off. But other than that, I don't think you should. Like Sarah said, and like AJ said, I very well suggest you guys watch this. I mean, it is hard. It is a very, very hard watch. Think of any and all police brutality videos that you've ever seen. on the internet, they probably like they have a video for each one of them here, basically. Like, it is not fun. So just prepare yourself for that. Like, I guess that's a trigger warning for police brutality, excessive use of force, stuff like that. But I love the production style. The actors reading the depositions, right? Like, I loved and hated it at the same time. We saw them do that with captive audience when we did captive audience. And that one made us feel a little weird because it was like they were trying to act like the characters that they were acting like. This one, they weren't. They even had Emmy Raver, an amazing, wonderful, brilliant Broadway actress, reading a deposition of a man. So it didn't really matter of, like, they weren't acting it out. So after I got over the shock of it, I was like, what is happening right now? Like, after I got over the shock of them reading out the depositions and stuff from officers, like on the record depositions and stuff, I was like, okay, I see what you're doing here. All right, I'm cool. I'm cool with it, you know? So I think it was a great docuseries. I don't think it overstated its welcome. 3 episodes. Well done. Like AJ said, if they wanted to add an extra episode, they would have had plenty to do so, I think. But I think they nailed it with just the 3. And then they weren't even long episodes. They were about like 37, 45 minutes-ish in between that. So like really easy to watch, really easy to binge in that way. But in content way, like not so much. So Colin Kaepernick, everybody over there did a phenomenal job. And so I'm going to give them a 4.5. So let's move on to our recommendations. AJ, do you have anything to recommend to our listeners?
I do have a few. Hey. I'm very appreciative that y'all are having me on the last day of Black History Month. And I will say, thank you. And Black History Month, it is a great feeling to see all these stories of all these great Black people that are not appreciated throughout the rest of the year finally get highlighted and get the respect that they deserve and for people to learn. But I believe, like Black History Month, just like AAPI Heritage, Hispanic Heritage, whatever, the month is not just a month to learn about these stories and exactly. Forget about the rest of the year. Like, I feel like this should be a constant process learning through. And I do have some Black recommendations. Tulsa Burning, talking about the Tulsa Massacre. The March on Washington, Keepers of the Dream. Aftershock, which is a documentary talking about Black women and their trials with healthcare, especially during childbirth.
Yes.
And I think on the line note, In Our Mother's Arms, which is a great generation stories about grandmothers and mothers and their relationships. I think all of those I recommend.
Great. Thank you so much for that, AJ. Sarah, do you have any recommendations?
Yes, I do. I have a podcast. So Bear Brook from New Hampshire Public Radio had its first season in 2018. Many of you would have listened to it. It contained the incredible investigative reporting on the Bodies in Barrels case from Bear Brook State Park. Truly one of the best crime podcasts of ever, as far as I'm concerned. And episode 1 of season 2 just dropped, and I just dropped everything to listen to it. It's looking at the murder of Sharon Johnson 35 years ago and the potential wrongful conviction in 1989 of then 19-year-old Jason Carroll. So get straight onto it. It's frustrating because it's an episode at a time, but I think the thoughtfulness that you can have between times. And I have to say with Killing County, I sometimes will go straight through. With Killing County, I had to stop after every episode just to, I wasn't actively thinking about it, but I was letting it sink in before I could move on to the next. So I don't know if it's a binge, but you may be able to binge it. If you haven't listened to season 1 of Bear Brook, you've got the whole season of that to listen to as well. And what about you, Murray? What do you have to recommend?
Okay, so something a little bit out of the ordinary here. I am from the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area. And when we were talking about it earlier, I definitely wanted to bring this up on a podcast, but courtwatchpg.com is a court watch organization where they get people to volunteer to sit in on hearings, especially bail hearings in PG County and in PG County District Court. It is very, very important that we keep an eye on the justice system because, you know, justice can be undone in the dark, you know? So CourtWatchPG.com is for the Maryland area, but I really suggest if it's something that interests you, look for any volunteer court watching around your area where you can volunteer your time to go sit in on hearings, especially bail hearings, to write what you see, collect reports and data about how the court system is working and if it is working. And then they normally take those reports and take it up to like to the courts to try and make a change. So definitely see if that's anything that you are interested in or doing or just donating to like a court watch near you. Other than that, for a property for a show, I would suggest please go watch Snowfall on FX on Wednesdays, or you can watch it on Hulu on Thursdays. Snowfall is in its final season. Me, Chappelle, and LaTanya are covering it over on Post Show Recaps. The We Got Y'all crew is back. We are covering again another final season of a show. So if you want to watch a show where police, the U.S. government, and law enforcement are actively participating in the crack epidemic of the 1980s. It's a very interesting show and we are tackling it. So at the very least, go listen to me, LaTanya and Chappelle, but definitely go watch Snowfall. It's a great show. It's almost akin to, I compare it to Breaking Bad for me, but it's really, really good. So that is my recommendation. At Crime Scene, we are eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's S-E-E-N. Or you can email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com.
We're on TikTok at crime.scene, S-E-E-N, and on Instagram and Facebook at Crime Scene Podcast.
AJ, what do you have going on? Where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at The Kid Norris. That's where I retweet anything I'm doing. I was recently on a couple podcasts that are currently outdated by the time this release, including one with the great Marty. All the rest of them wrap up. But also, you can catch me every week on Two Can't Keep a Secret with me and my great co-host Jay, talking Pretty Little Liars, having great, important conversations, and a fun time every now and then. Most time it's fun.
Awesome. Sarah, what do you have going on? Where can the people find you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. I'm writing about Australian Survivor, heroes versus villains for Inside Survivor each week. I'm recapping Taskmaster Australia with Ninja Warrior Sean Bryan for Silent Podcast. So that's, we're having fun and some very interesting guests there. And over on Post Show Recaps, I'm talking all things Outer Banks, Season 3, Pogues for Life with Mary Kwiatkowski. If you want to catch up, you'll find our Season 1 and Season 2 coverage over there as well. And what about you, Mari, other than Snowfall? What other many, many things are you doing?
Right. Well, of course, every week, me and Mascot bring you the highlights of the week in wrestling. I was not on this week. I was celebrating my son's 4th birthday, but you can join Mascot and his wonderful guests as they break down the highlights of the week in wrestling. Again, you don't have to watch wrestling because we are fun. We have fun guests. We tell you everything you need to know. Plus, we provide a very handy playlist that you can watch the clips as we talk about them. So please go and check us out. We had a very fun RHAP Grams takeover. And so go check us out by going to robhaswebsite.com/wrestlingfeed and subscribe to us over there. Like I said, subscribe to the Snowfall feed. We are still working on that, but just go over to postshowrecaps.com and you'll find us. We are on all of our previous feeds. So if you listen to the We Got Y'all crew on Insecure or on Atlanta, we dropped the Snowfall preview show in those feeds. So hopefully you heard it. And then I think it'll be in the Atlanta feed moving forward, and we will then rename that feed. So just go and check it out. And of course, follow me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much, like the number 2. If I'm doing any guest spots or anything, I will post that. Other than that, Next time on Crime Scene, we're covering She Said with LaTanya Starks. Watch it on Peacock in the US and Apple TV in Australia, and send us your comments and questions. Thanks to AJ for joining us, Will from America for the theme music, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Chelsea Lesser and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time, case closed.